This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The bottom line is that people should have the right to vote, and every vote should count. You know, that's why I say if Democrats are smart, and I think the leadership is smart, they will bring this issue front and center and be like, we are the party of voting. We are the party of, you know, where every vote should count. The other party is the party that says not every vote should count. Now we turn to the voters and we say, you decide, which one do you like?
Did you know that in last week's election, only half of eligible voters turned out? And that turnout was surprisingly robust, as election prognosticators expected it to be more in the 35 to 40% range. Well, smart political strategists are trying to change the political landscape by engaging the significant piece of the pie that is eligible non-voters. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to John Storr, an opinion columnist at the New Haven Register and publisher of the editorial board, to get his thoughts on the recent midterm elections. We try to make sense of the results of last Tuesday's election, examine voter suppression tactics in places like Georgia and Florida, and talk about the impact of door-to-door canvassing.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by John Storr. He is a columnist at the New Haven Register, and he's the editor and publisher of The Editorial Board, which is a daily newsletter about politics. John, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So, since we spoke last, the Democrats have taken the House, and the Republicans have held serve in the Senate, but I wanted to get your reflections on the hullabaloo that was building up to the midterms and the aftermath of it as well.
Right. So one of the things that I tried to do as we were coming on to the midterms is maintain focus on one fundamental thing, which was that this is a historically unpopular president. And yes, he's going to go out to places like Missouri and Indiana, and lots of people are going to go to his rallies, and it's going to have the appearance of, oh my God, he's going to turn the election against us being the Democrats, and there's occasion for paranoia and panic. But lo and behold, an unpopular president loses. He loses the House. He loses a lot of governorships. He lost hundreds of lower offices in the states. And he was also unpopular at a time when the Tea Party movement was really starting to decay and kind of fall apart. People had had enough of that on the state level. Those two trends, plus the fact that the Democrats really only had to brush their teeth, comb their hair, and stand up straight, and they would be an interesting and valuable contrast to the people in power. All those things combined resulted in what we saw on last Tuesday. Yes, the Democrats did not win the Senate, but the odds of their winning the Senate were already so stacked against them. It wasn't just a matter of red states being red. It was the historical numbers that were really against the Democrats. They had to defend way more senators than they could actually. They had to spend their resources defending senators, and so therefore you had less to work with when it came to going on the offense. When it came to the wins, there's really two threads to pay attention to. The Democrats performed really well. This is the first thread. The Democrats did really well in state elections, including governor, in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, right? Those are the three states that won it for Trump. So that's one thread where the Democrats did really well on the state level. And then you have this other thread, which is like in the Sun Belt. So we flipped Nevada, we flipped Arizona, we came within a hair of flipping...
Texas and Georgia.
Texas and Georgia, exactly. So you see the thread here, like there's a lot of momentum building. Bear in mind, in 2020, when the next set of senators is up for election, we're still going to have this unpopular president. I just can't imagine that he'll be popular. But let's just assume that he's going to be the same guy that we've known for the past 2 years. That gives the Democrats yet another chance to flip other Senate seats that are that will be on the defensive, because at this point the Republicans will be running for re-election. So that's really interesting that we seem to be holding some ground in our traditional Midwest states, and then making inroads in places previously completely dominated by the Republicans. I think there's a lot to celebrate from last Tuesday.
Yes, there's for sure a lot to celebrate. I hope that the right lessons sink in to the Democratic Party leadership. When I think of Mitch McConnell saying, well, Joe Manchin voted for Kavanaugh, while Heidi Heitkamp and Joe Donnelly voted and Claire McCaskill voted against him, and they lost and Manchin won. And it just seemed like a silly argument in many ways, but it penetrated into moderate Democratic circles. I have a friend who's a centrist Democrat who thought that this was a valid reason. For me, it sounded absurd. If you look at the margins that Heidi Heitkamp and McCaskill and Donnelly lost by, these were incumbents, and they lost by 5% or more, while Beto O'Rourke and Andrew Gillum and Stacey Abrams, who were unabashedly progressive candidates, came within a hair of winning. I think that's really the takeaway I had, more than Manchin, who was a governor in West Virginia and a pretty popular name in his state, he held serve.
Yeah, I think I agree that that would be the wrong lesson to take away. I think I read somewhere that Donnelly... those for and against Donnelly were 50-50 when it came to Kavanaugh, which tells you that, you know, a coin toss is what made the difference. I don't think Kavanaugh made much difference to Republican voters. I think people in Indiana were voting for Trump. You know, people in Missouri were voting for Trump. Same thing with North Dakota.
I also think that Kavanaugh, the way that those politicians kind of hemmed and hawed on Kavanaugh, did not reflect well on their leadership abilities. When you hear that Donnelly is going to wait until he hears about what McCaskill's going to do and what Susan Collins is doing before he gives his thumbs up or thumbs down, that is the kind of mealy-mouthed lack of decision-making that I think both Democratic voters and Republican voters are fed up with.
Yeah, well, now he's gone. You know, Donnelly is gone and McCaskill is gone.
And that's why I think Beto O'Rourke's candidacy rang true for so many people across the country. Why he got all this money, why he got all these volunteers, why that NFL kneeling video, 4 minutes of him responding to a question, was such a revelation for so many potential voters, because the framing of it, I thought, was brilliant. They said, I don't know if listeners aren't familiar with what I'm talking about. Somebody asked at one of his campaign stops in a kind of informal setting, and it was videotaped and it went viral. He said, you know, I'm disgusted by NFL players kneeling for the anthem. Do you think it's unpatriotic, and what can we do about it? And he said, the short answer is no. And then he went into a very didactic, learned explanation for why he believes it's okay for these people to protest. He talks about Rosa Parks and goes back to the civil rights movement and connects those dots very effectively. But I think the key was that he first said no. He gave a short answer, and so you knew what he was saying right away. And I really think that type of framing is so refreshing.
Yeah. Well, he gave a liberal answer to a conservative question, too.
But he's done that a lot. I watched a lot of his videos. It wasn't not, he says his answer. He says yes or no, and here's why. I think that framing is so, just like that New Yorker cartoon that had the sheep in the field and then a wolf that was on a billboard and says, I'm going to eat you. And one of the sheep says to the other sheep, hey, say what you will. At least he tells it like it is. You know, like this was more about Trump. But there is something that people find refreshing about a quote-unquote straight talker.
Right. And that's sort of what I mean by a liberal answer to a conservative question. The problem with the Democrats really, and I actually don't see this as a problem currently, but we're kind of getting over this long hangover of what we used to call the blue dogs, which was really more or less Democrats willing to race bait in their own way in order to win over white working class voters. And one of the reasons that doesn't work anymore is because the Democratic Party just won't tolerate it, meaning the base of the Democratic Party. And the other reason is that, well, why do that when you have somebody like Trump doing that and so much more? And all you have to do to win is stand in some contrast against that, you know, and try to elevate your position higher above him. And I think O'Rourke did that. Gillum was very good at doing that, just as Stacey Abrams, when they were both running for the governors of their states, did that as well. They gave assertive, strong, liberal answers to whatever questions were given to them. As opposed to what happened in the past is that a person like Bill Clinton would take a conservative frame and kind of just nudge it in the direction he wants to go in. And when I say conservative frame, accept as true some conservative assumptions, right, about what's true, and then kind of try to move it along, kill it to death with details in a lot of ways. But O'Rourke wasn't doing that. He would just say, you know, people who kneel have a right to kneel, and the people who fought and died for his right to kneel, you know, and that's a classic liberal response. And it's so, you know, in opposition with Trump and his ways, it's so crystal clear. And that's one of the things that we're experiencing right now that's so different from when you and I were teenagers. It was hard to tell the difference between a Democrat and a Republican 25 years ago. It was just really hard. You know, there were obviously liberal Democrats. That was, you could tell who they were. But when it came to some of Democrats, it was hard to tell the difference. But now, you know, you could throw a stone and hit a Democrat, and you know that that's a Democrat because of the way they talk.
Particularly in the Northeast, if you're looking at like Rhode Island or Massachusetts, I mean, there was not much of a demarcation line.
That's right. Yeah, and so we're living in this really interesting time now. We used to have the era of dog whistle racism, you know, where you spoke in code and you're kind of communicating covertly with the people you want to get to. You know, now everything's like bullhorn racism, where, you know, people are sending explicit messages about race, like the guy who ran it for governor in Florida, DeSantis. He was just clearly saying exactly who he wants.
Let's not monkey up the race, right? I mean, it was so ugly.
It was really clear, right? And it's only getting clearer from people like him because they have the incentive to do that, right? If it works, they'll keep doing it. And the more it works, the more they'll keep doing it. And they won't stop really until it stops working.
Say every man needs protection. They say every man must fall. So I swear I see my reflection. And
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to John Storr. He's a columnist at the New Haven Register and the editor and publisher of The Editorial Board, which is a daily newsletter about politics. So, John, speaking about the Blue Dogs' struggle within the Democratic Party, I can't help but think that Democrats would also be wise to think just from a pure calculus of trying to grab as many voters as possible, is the struggle over that creamy center, those moderate voters, are just basically struggling over crumbs while betraying your principles. You have to kind of prevaricate and hem and haw, saying, oh, I like the Yankees and the Red Sox. You know, you don't want to get anybody angry about things. While really what I think somebody like Beto O'Rourke's candidacy revealed, and what I think his campaign understood, was they recognize that the pie is so much bigger if you expand into that 40% of people who don't vote. I got some messaging from the O'Rourke campaign that said, Texas is not a red state. We consider it a non-voting state. And they said, you know, Greg Abbott beat Wendy Davis in a landslide victory by over 20 percentage points when he won in 2014. But there was under 32% turnout for that election, which means it was around 19% of registered Texas voters voted for their current governor in the quote-unquote landslide victory. So I think that's where the opportunity lies in so many of these states where, and we can get into voter suppression and how voting has become a partisan issue remarkably in this era.
Yeah, that I think since 2016, it's really been healthy for the Republic to be talking and debating and arguing about people who don't vote. There's this wonderful unwillingness to accept people's nonsensical excuses. Mm-hmm. You know, in the past, it was like, well, okay, you know, that's your decision. And people are more prone to say, no, it's not your decision. You know, you have a responsibility. You have an obligation. You know, that is such a wonderful thing to be hearing. You will hear some young people saying, well, don't shame us. That would just make us not vote more. People are not buying that argument. You know, they're saying, no, we are going to shame you and we will continue to harangue you until you do the right thing. And that seems to have gotten a lot of people off their duffs. And, you know, this was a historic turnout. This past midterm was a historic turnout.
Well, I was down in Texas. My family and I flew down to Dallas, and we were in the Fort Worth area knocking on doors for Beto O'Rourke. So I had and this was getting out the vote. So it wasn't necessarily, mm-hmm. It wasn't voter persuasion time. It was, you should vote. I'd be getting a sandwich from somebody at the store who looked like they could be a new voter. I said, are you registered to vote? And they're like, yeah, I am, but I'm not going to vote. Not this time around. I'm like, why not? And my daughter was right there. She's 11. I'm like, what would you do when you're 18? And she was like, vote. And I think this girl went and voted. She was like, all right, I will. And I had so many of those interactions with potential voters who were like, you know, I wasn't going to vote, but now that I've talked to you, I'm going to. And even if, you know, not all of them are going to fulfill that pledge, just making that interaction with somebody and having them acknowledge that maybe they are going to do this now, actually, the data shows that that is the most effective way of getting somebody to the polls.
That's exactly right. You know, I just thought of a factoid from way back in 2008 when Barack Obama was supposedly created the year of the youth vote, right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that he did not spend as much resources on the youth as he did on traditional voters over the age of 60 or so. Mm-hmm. It was he out of every 100 people he made physical made contact either by phone or by mailer or something. 94 out of 100 of people over the age of 60, and it was way less. It was something like 30 out of 100 for people under 30. And so, you know, even then you could see, like, it was, we talked about the youth vote, but it really wasn't the youth vote, you know. But it's such a contrast to now, you know, that now you have the Democrats, it's almost like they rediscovered, you know, door knocking. You know, it's like, oh, you know, this actually works. So, you know, when you get out there and drive people out to vote who haven't voted before. And not only that, but they're not just focusing on registering people to vote. That's another key thing, is that people who say they're registered to vote often don't vote. Where the Democrats would stop is they would say, are you registered? And the person would say, yes, I'm registered. And then they would stop with their persuasion, right? They'd be like, okay, my job is done. You're registered. No, you got to get the registered person out to vote. It's not enough just to
A voting plan with them. You say, do you know how you're getting to the polls? Do you need any help getting to the polls? What time do you think is going to be there? You may want to be there kind of late morning to avoid the lines. You got to kind of be there ally in coming up with a plan, and that's been proven to be very effective.
Just get them to think about it, because there's a million things going on in life, and the last, you know, you have 99 problems and one of them is not going to vote, right? But if you get them to think about it, so just the act of getting them to think, oh, well, you know, here I actually know how I could do it if I just got, you know, had the motivation. Well, there you go, you have the motivation now.
And as somebody who's knocked on doors since 2004, this for me was a sea change in terms of the technology finally catching up, because I've always struggled with the paperwork that comes with knocking on all these doors. But working in Texas, everything was on your smartphone. The only issue you had was battery anxiety. Is your phone going to have enough juice to do this? But it was incredible. Like we had a group of 4 to 6 people at all times, and in 4 days we knocked on over 800 doors. There's no way we would have come even close to 400 or 500 if we didn't have these smart devices. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was called Polis, P-O-L-L-I-S. It'd be an interesting article to write about. Like, it made the experience of going door to door incredibly efficient. And I think that is going to be an important answer to voter suppression activities that are happening from the other side. Besides, you know, getting 7 governors in office in this last election who are Democrats, that's an important shot across the bow as well.
Yeah, speaking of voter suppression, I mean, unless you're in power, you know, if a Democrat is not in power, then what is your answer to voter suppression? There's only one answer, and that is turning out an overwhelming number of people, you know, from all walks of life, through voting in polls all across a state. I mean, you want to see people, you want to see people, you know, clogging the lines, like, because it's only a sheer mass of numbers that's going to overcome whatever voter suppression tactics are trying to suppress your vote. And then hopefully you'll get into a situation where you can have power and you can turn things around. But going back to voting rights as a partisan issue, mm-hmm. I welcome that. I think that's a totally, like, yay, let's have that argument. I want to have that argument because I will win that argument each and every time.
I'm guessing, is that because when people are challenged on having their rights taken away from them, it gets more people out? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, that's one thing. That tends to irritate people. It tends to irritate people who, even if they just think of they don't think of voting as a duty, but they do think of it as a right. And if they see some effort to take that away, it gives them more incentive to exercise that right. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that's one thing. But also, just, you know, in the public sphere, you know, like, if we're going to have. We're going to have an argument about the right to vote. You know, what's the argument against having the right to vote? You know, the argument will be something like, well, only legal votes should be counted, only citizens should vote. And these are like really small ball arguments that can be just basically tossed aside and be like, okay, we'll figure out some mechanism to keep people from voting illegally. In fact, we have those mechanisms already in abundance. But the bottom line is that people should have the right to vote, and every vote should count. You know, that's why I say if Democrats are smart, and I think the leadership is smart, they will bring this issue front and center and be like, we are the party of voting. You know, we are the party of, you know, where every vote should count. The other party is the party that says not every vote should count. Now we turn to the voters and we say, you decide, which one do you like?
And we're seeing that played out in Georgia and Florida right now.
That's right. That's where we're seeing it played out now. And people who, and you, what you're also seeing in Florida is in Georgia is no concessions, right? They're not just preemptively conceding defeat. You know, Andrew Gillum and Stacey Abrams are saying, no, 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 we are not. This is not my father's Democratic Party.
And that's why 2004 was so depressing for me personally, when I saw so many shenanigans going on in Ohio, and John Kerry just immediately was kind of cornered into, you can't put the country through what we went through in 2000. You have to concede right away. And that was it. And then It was like no sour grapes, and they let the media kind of dictate the narrative. But in that same election, As an aside, so I was an election protection official, a nonpartisan official in South Florida, in Miami, and was watching what was happening on election day that day. And it really, it was the first time I had really kind of participated on the ground, and talking to a large number of people who are standing in line after the polls closed, saying, you are in line, even though the polls have closed, you have the right to vote no matter what anyone tells you. Like, I still get choked up thinking about that, like just saying those words, like kind of out loud, made me tear up and made me patriotic, for lack of a better word. Like that activated me.
Absolutely. I see the Democratic Party really moving in the direction of not just rights, but in duties. You know, we not just individuals, but communities. In other words, more arguments for the greater good. You know, not so much arguments for individuals or individual or group identity rights. You know, this is really in keeping with a larger liberal tradition. You know, that, you know, what's important is you, as a citizen, you not only have the right to vote, but you should vote, right? And we don't vote just for yourself. You vote for your neighbor, and your neighbor's voting for his neighbor, and so on and so forth.
And you, little person who doesn't have a lot of money, can go out and convince 50 people to vote the way you want them to vote.
That's right.
Which is maybe just as effective as some multimillionaire who's given thousands of dollars to campaigns, because your door-to-door activity can be just as effective as that money for an ad.
That's exactly right. And the Republicans don't have a response to this, you know, because, well, for a lot of reasons, one being Trump is president, but two, conservatism has really... they don't have any more ideas. It's been a broken record for 40 years, you know, cutting regulations, cutting taxes, blah, blah, blah. No more, limited government, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, no, people don't, you know, how many people even said they voted based on the tax cut? I don't think anybody did. You know, they didn't care. And educated Republicans who live in wealthy suburbs, they didn't vote based on tax cuts. I mean, those are the people who should have rewarded the Republicans, right? But they didn't. They voted for Democrats.
Exactly. John Storr, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Bill Withers and Nina Simone. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.